I thought it was the New Morality did that.
We're part of the New Morality. The Urban Corps, the Angels of God, the Disciples of Allah, St. Michael's Battalion. There are dozens of organizations within the New Morality structure.
Uh-huh.
We want your help, Jack.
Mine? What for?
You've worked for years at Moonbase. We need to know all about Moonbase, what they're doing up there, how they operate, what they're planning.
Why?
Melissa looked disappointed. Jack, they work with nanomachines at Moonbase, don't they?
They've got to, he said.
Nanomachines will soon be illegal, she said. We've got to know how the people at Moonbase will react to the new law.
Kilifer turned away from her and looked out at the city again. It was so shining and lush it almost looked unreal. It all seemed clean and fresh and quiet. Hardly any noise from street traffic. No boomboxes blasting away. No voices raised.
What's in it for me?
He asked, still without looking at her.
If his self-centered question bothered her, Melissa Hart gave no hint of it. She immediately answered, "We'll hire you as a consultant at $1,500 a day, with a guarantee of a minimum of 100 consulting days per year."
$150,000 per year, Kilifer realized.
That should augment your Masterson Corporation pension very nicely, she added.
My pension, yeah. He wanted to spit.
It's a very generous offer, Jack.
For how many years?
Sounding slightly disappointed again, she replied, "Oh, Jack, I can't promise you more than this 1 year. If everything goes the way we expect it to, Moonbase will be shut down by the end of that time."
And then what happens to me?
We'll see, she said simply,
with a glowing smile. But her eyes still radiated pain. Kilifer thought it over briefly.
What the hell, he said. Why not?
Then you agree?
If you'll come to dinner with me.
She seemed to think it over with great care. At last Melissa said, "I'd be happy to have dinner with you, Jack, but only dinner."
"Sure," he said. "Just dinner."
It was a lie, and he knew that she knew it.
The north end of Boston had once been an Italian preserve, but over the decades it had evolved into Little Asia. Vietnamese, Malay, Thai, Indian, and a dozen varieties of Chinese now occupied the narrow, twisting streets where once a patriot had climbed the old North Church bell tower to signal Paul Revere. Over spicy Hunan platters, Kilifer found himself spinning out his life story to this beautiful black woman with haunted eyes. As if he couldn't stop himself, he spilled out the bitterness, the rage and frustration of his wasted life.
"But why did you spend all those years in Moonbase?" Melissa asked, sweetly, chopsticks held gracefully in her long, slim fingers.
"When you had such a promising career in nanotechnology."
"She did it," he growled.
"Masterson's widow. Then she married Stavanger. She stuck me in Moonbase."
"But you could have resigned and come back to Earth, couldn't you?"
He hadn't intended to tell her about the nanobugs and Greg Masterson and Paul Stavanger's murder. He had never intended to speak of that at all. But by the time dinner was finished and they were walking the crowded, brightly lit streets, he had revealed himself to her almost completely.
"Greg Masterson murdered his stepfather."
There was something in the way she said it that brought Kilifer up short, something in her voice.
"You know Greg Masterson?"
She nodded. In the harsh glare of the street lamp, her face looked like frozen stone.
"I knew him. Long ago."
They walked in painful silence down to the waterfront, where the streets were emptier and darker.
"My apartment's up there."
Kilifer pointed to an apartment block across the street from the piers.
"You must have a nice view," Melissa said absently,
sounding as if her thoughts were a quarter million miles away.
"Come on up and see it," he suggested, taking her by the arm.
She disengaged effortlessly.
"No, Jack," she said. "It doesn't work that way."
"Come on," he wheedled. "Just have a drink with me."
With a smile that might have been sad or perhaps pitying, Melissa said,
"You don't understand, Jack. I'm celibate."
"You're what?"
"I've been celibate since I met General O'Connor many years ago."
"Celibate?"
"It's part of our creed."
"You mean everybody I saw in your building?"
She nodded.
"That's hard to believe."
"Believe it, Jack. Celibacy removes one of the great causes of pain in this life."
"But But you're so beautiful. It's a damned shame, a waste.
Her eyes flared. No, it's not a waste. I know what pain can be caused by the attractions of sex. I was caught in that web once, years ago. It led to nothing but pain and evil, drugs and self-destruction. I nearly killed myself before General O'Connor found me.
General O'Connor?
He wasn't the general then. He hadn't even founded the Urban Corps yet. But he saved my life. He made me dedicate my life to the new morality and all that it stands for.
And you gotta be celibate?
It simplifies your life, Jack. It allows you to concentrate your energies on the things that really matter.
Still seems like a damned waste to me, Killifer grumbled.
No, Jack. It makes life so much easier, cleaner. Come back to the office tomorrow, Jack. I want you to join us. We need your help.
Killifer thought, maybe this celibate crap is just her excuse. After all, we just met this afternoon. Give it time, she'll pull her pants down sooner or later. Okay, he said lightly. See you tomorrow morning.
9 sharp, said Melissa.
Right.
He left her at the street corner and went into his apartment building.
She didn't seem to have the slightest fear of being alone on the dark street.
Ginny Anson stared at her husband.
What do you mean? She demanded.
Just what I said, he replied calmly, his teeth clamped on his favorite briar pipe. You've got to submit your syllabus to a freaking committee?
His studied composure irritated her. It's not as if this is the first time, he said.
But this committee's got nothing to do with the university, she said.
Her husband shrugged. It's a local citizens group. They call themselves the Moral Watchdogs or something like that.
Moral dipshits, Anson muttered.
Her husband gave her a disapproving frown. He was obviously afraid his young daughters might hear her language, even though the door to their bedroom was firmly shut and the kids were down in the rec room watching video on their new wall-to-wall, window-wall screen. Quentin Westlake was a sweet, gentle professor of English literature at the University of Texas. It had taken him 10 years to work his way from various outlying campuses in the vast hinterlands of the state to the main campus at Austin. Along the way, he had married, fathered 2 daughters, and divorced when his first wife fell in love with an investment broker from Chicago. Ginny Anson had met him at a seminar in Lubbock, where she had been invited to participate in a panel discussion of literature in the space age. Ginny had been the only panel member who was not an English lit professor, and Quentin had been the only one among them who had treated her with kindness. It was a different kind of romance, with Ginny commuting every few months from Moonbase to Texas, and Quentin trying to convince his 2 prepubescent daughters that he wouldn't marry anyone who would turn into a wicked stepmother. When Ginny took her regular annual leave from the directorship of Moonbase, the commute became easier, merely from Savannah to Austin. By the time she returned to the moon, they had decided to get married. Their wedding was at the Alamo, as scheduled, with Quentin's 2 daughters serving as bridesmaids and Joanna Stavanger among the guests. Joanna's best wedding present was to allow Ginny to transfer to the corporation's manufacturing facility in Houston. She could commute to work now on the high-speed Levitrain from Austin. In addition to her regular duties, Ginny was supervising construction of a model water recycling center for the city of Houston, based on the technology perfected at Moonbase. It made for very long days, but at least she was home each night with her husband. Most nights. For nearly 6 months now, Ginny had lived in his 3-bedroom, ranch-style house in suburban Austin, getting acclimatized to raising 2 half-grown daughters and to the intricate jealousies and competitions of a major university's faculty. She quickly fell in love with the girls. The other faculty wives and women professors and administrators she felt she could gladly do without. Now, as they were undressing for bed, Quentin told her about the new committee that would be reviewing his work. She knew he was concerned about it, despite his easygoing attitude. He wouldn't have brought up the subject if it didn't bother him. But what right does a self-appointed gaggle of uptight new morality people have to pass judgment on your syllabus? Ginny asked, aggrieved. Quentin smiled wearily and rubbed the forefinger of his right hand against its thumb. Money talks, sweetheart. Some of those committee members are among the biggest contributors to the university.
It's an invasion of academic freedom, Ginny snarled.
Sure it is, he agreed amiably. Though what can I do about it?
The Jews don't like the Merchant of